Tonight we come to chapter 3, the Godward emotions, which saw print on the 15th of June, 1918. An essay that remained unrevised as all of these in the Yoga of Divine Love were never touched by Sri Aurobindo after they appeared originally. So we have it now as it was then. There are lots of references as we go through this tonight to passages from the Gita, notes here and there, and I hope you'll be patient. I hope it'll be interesting. The Godward emotions. The principle of yoga is to turn Godward all or any of the powers of the human consciousness so that through that activity of the being there may be contact, relation, union. So he means that quite literally, that anything that is dynamic, that is active in us, whether it's intelligence, whether it's a feeling or an emotion or a physical activity, can be made the means of a living connection with the divine. In the yoga of bhakti, it is the emotional nature that is made the instrument. Its main principle is to adopt some human relation between man and the divine being, by which, through the ever intenser flowing of the heart's emotions towards him, the human soul may at last be wedded to and grow one with him in a passion of divine love. So this familiar principle with Sri Aurobindo, from the near to the far. Begin with your human emotions, begin with the feelings that you have, the nature of the happy relationships that stand in your life, and you begin with those as an accommodating approach to the divine. But it should lead progressively to a penetration of being, a felt contact. It is not ultimately the pure peace of oneness or the power and desireless will of oneness, but the ecstatic joy of union which the devotee seeks by his yoga. So peace is fine for the jnana, making commensurate one's will with the divine's will is perfection itself for the karma yogin. But for the heart, it is love. It is the rapturous union with the divine that the bhakta seeks. Every feeling that can make the heart ready for this ecstasy, the yoga admits. Everything that detracts from it must increasingly drop away as the strong union of love becomes closer and more perfect. All the feelings with which religion approaches the worship, service, and love of God, the yoga admits, if not as its final accompaniments, yet as preparatory movements of the emotional nature. But there is one feeling with which the yoga, at least as practiced in India, has very little dealing. In certain religions, in most perhaps, the idea of the fear of God plays a very large part, sometimes the largest. And the God-fearing man is the typical worshiper of these religions. Sri Aurobindo removes most of Indian spiritual literature from that perspective. There are occasions, of course, in the Upanishads, for instance, in the Katha Upanishad, where Yama describes to his disciple that the gods move in fear of Brahman to keep the universe going. They are impelled. But it is a rather friendly relationship that the gods have with the Godhead. The sentiment of fear is indeed perfectly consistent with devotion of a certain kind, and up to a certain point. At its highest, it rises into a worship of the divine power, the divine justice, divine law, divine righteousness and ethical obedience, and awed reverence for the Almighty Creator and Judge. Its motive is therefore ethico-religious, and it belongs not so strictly to the devotee, but to the man of works moved by a devotion to the divine ordainer and judge of his works. I will act so as to please this huge being to whom I owe my utter dedication. It regards God as the king and does not approach too near the glory of his throne unless justified by righteousness or led there by a mediator who will turn away the divine wrath for sin. Even when it draws nearest, it keeps an odd distance between itself and the high object of its worship. It cannot embrace the divine with all the fearless confidence of the child in his mother, or of the lover in his beloved, or with that intimate sense of oneness which perfect love brings with it. Yes, well, clearly Sri Aurobindo is writing about, but not mentioning, the religions of the Judeo-Christian tradition, but you could say the Semitic religions, because all of them, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, share some of these traits. But note how Sri Aurobindo comes back to this. Confidence of a child in his mother, like the Shakta, like the Rig Veda, where one lies in the lap of the divine, or of the lover and his beloved. So much of the Puranas speak to that. Also the Gita approaches it again and again, with the intimate sense of oneness which perfect love brings. The later traditions of bhakti enter into this as well. The origin of this divine fear was crude enough in some of the primitive popular religions. Oh, pardon me. I've become violent. It was the perception of powers in the world greater than man, obscure in their nature and workings, which seemed always ready to strike him down in his prosperity and to smite him for any actions which displeased them. Fear of the gods arose from man's ignorance of God and his ignorance of the laws that govern the world. It attributed to the higher powers caprice and human passion. It made them in the image of the great ones of the earth, capable of whim, tyranny, personal enmity, jealous of any greatness in man which might raise him above the littleness of terrestrial nature and bring him too near to the divine nature. Well, we see this theme playing out in Greek and Roman mythology also. So it's not simply the theistic religions from, say, the beginning of the Common Era on that feature in this. Anthropomorphic is the theme here. With such notions, no real devotion could arise, except that doubtful kind which the weaker may feel for the stronger, whose protection he can buy by worship and gifts and propitiation and obedience to such laws as he may have laid upon those beneath him and may enforce by rewards and punishments, or else the submissive and prostrate reverence and adoration which one may feel for a greatness, glory, wisdom, sovereign power, which is above the world and is the source, or at any rate, the regulator of all its laws and happenings. Now, clearly, this is an element of a much kinder and more benevolent picture of the divine being, which we find as Purushottama in the Bhagavad Gita. But we also have this idea written about persuasively by Rudolf Otto in his Idea of the Holy, in which he looks at the mysterium tremendum, this great mysterious being who is awe-inspiring, who dominates, who dwarfs, who engulfs. This, Otto felt, was the signature of the typical religious experience, that one comes to know God face to face in this way: I am small, you are beyond measure. A nearer approach to the beginnings of the way of devotion becomes possible when this element of divine power disengages itself from these crudities and fixes on the idea of a divine ruler, creator of the world and master of the law, who governs the earth and heavens and is the guide and helper and savior of his creatures. Well, we catch this in lots of spiritual literature, but we mentioned the Gita, so here are some citations. Chapter 8, shlokas 1 through 4. Chapter 11, shlokas 37 and 38. Chapter 9, shlokas 11 through 14. This larger and higher idea of the divine being long kept many elements, and still keeps some elements, of the old crudity. The Jews, who brought it forward most prominently and from whom it overspread a great part of the world, could believe in a God of righteousness who was exclusive, arbitrary, wrathful, jealous, often cruel, and even wantonly sanguinary. Even now, it is possible for some to believe in a creator who has made heaven and hell, and eternal hell, the two poles of his creation, and has, even according to some religions, predestined the souls he has created not only to sin and punishment, but to an eternal damnation. So we have elements of this in Manichaeanism, Zoroastrianism, and some of this is not Judaic, but Christian in orientation. And we can look in modern Protestant faiths like the Presbyterian to find elements of this clearly and continually articulated. But even apart from these extravagances to a childish religious belief, the idea of the Almighty Judge, Legislator, King is a crude and imperfect idea of the divine when taken by itself, because it takes an inferior and an external truth for the main truth, and it tends to prevent a higher approach to a more intimate reality. This is interesting, this idea of a king, and those of you who have read the King James Version of the Bible have frequently come across the passage, Kingdom of God. And you even find that phrase in the Aramaic in the Gospel according to St. Thomas, but then translated into Greek, where the term becomes basileia, which has a kind of spatial connotation and probably could be translated better as imperial rule. And it's talking about the width and the breadth of the kingdom. What Sri Aurobindo is writing about here is a relationship of the ruled with the ruler. It's not where's the place, but who is the person with a capital P with whom one is relating. So the king here on earth, in a sense, would be an analog to the king who is the divine creator of all things. And we find that represented also in Tantra, because it is a very much a feature of Tantrism that the king should live in felt communion with the Godhead worshipped, so that that human king becomes the voice, becomes the active principle governing the human community as the divine would will it to be governed, and as the divine governs above in the celestial spheres, so that the earth becomes a reflection, and human society a reflection too, of that happier choir of beings above. We should also note in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is himself a king. Krishna is Purushottama and is both above and below, bringing into conjunction the spiritual and the material. An idea, of course, which Christianity speaks to richly. Back to our text. It exaggerates the importance of the sense of sin, and thereby prolongs and increases the soul's fear and self-distrust and weakness. It attaches the pursuit of virtue and the shunning of sin to the idea of rewards and punishment, though given in an afterlife, and makes them dependent on the lower motives of fear and interest instead of the higher spirit, which should govern the ethical being. If you go look at the early chapters of Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you'll see that there, here's the template, the divine considering what it wants to do with its own being, has a moment, it says, of fear, but then realizes there is none other. I am the only being. So could what if I be afraid? Obviously, it's the human way of resolving the issue. So, who is complete in being is fearless. Who is whole, who is integral in composition, has no fear. It is impossible. It cannot arise. So it isn't for the delight of heaven that one wants to contact to the divine. Sri Aurobindo connotes that there's something more. The suggestion is a bigger reality than that. Again, it makes heaven and hell, and not the divine himself, the object of the human soul in its religious living. These crudities have served their turn in the slow education of the human mind, but they are of no utility to the yogin who knows that whatever truth they may represent belongs rather to the external relations of the developing human soul with the external law of the universe than any intimate truth of the inner relations of the human soul with the divine. But it is these which are the proper field of yoga. So let the law obeyers obey the law, and let us move into communion with the Supreme. Still, out of this conception, there arise certain developments which bring us nearer to the threshold of the yoga of devotion. First, there can emerge the idea of the divine as the source and law and aim of our ethical being, and from this there can come the knowledge of him as the highest self to which our active nature aspires, the will to which we have to assimilate our will, the eternal right and purity and truth and wisdom into harmony with which our nature has to grow and towards whose being our being is attracted. So we move towards the highest self, the Paramatman, through Karma Yoga. By this way, we arrive at the Yoga of Works. And this yoga has a place for personal devotion to the divine, for the divine will appears as the master of our works, to whose voice we must listen, whose divine impulsion we must obey, and whose work it is the sole business of our active life and will to do. Remember that word attract. We'll come back to it. Secondly, there emerges the idea of the divine spirit, the father of all, who extends his wings of benignant protection and love over all his creatures. And from that grows between the soul and the divine the relation of father and child, a relation of love, and as a result, the relation of brotherhood with our fellow beings. These relations of the divine into the calm, pure light of whose nature we have to grow, and the master whom we approach through works and service, the father who responds to the love of the soul that approaches him as the child, are admitted elements of the yoga of devotion. So these two things, the attractive source which calls us to perfection, that's the first. And then the loving and protective supreme who blesses our path forward, who draws us ineluctably towards him or her. This idea of the attraction. We talked about the mysterium tremendum. There is also the mysterium fascinosum, that unknown divine who is fascinating, who attracts, who beguiles and leads and ultimately captures us. Remember Sir Francis Thompson's poem, The Hound of Heaven, ruthlessly pursuing us through all our paths. We take a step towards that, that takes, she takes, he takes two steps towards you. The moment we come well into these developments and their deeper spiritual meaning, the motive of the fear of God becomes otios, superfluous and even impossible. Otios, again from Latin, otiosus, which means leisure. So in English it means really unoccupied, without function, idle. Fear is useless to us. As yogins and yoginis, it is of importance chiefly in the ethical field when the soul has not yet grown sufficiently to follow good for its own sake and needs an authority above it, whose wrath or stern, passionless judgment it can fear, and found upon that fear its fidelity to virtue. So in the Tantra, this would be the stage of the pashu, the animal who has to be driven according to his animal nature to grow into something greater. So eventually one becomes daivik, divine in nature. When we grow into spirituality, this motive can no longer remain except by the lingering on of some confusion in the mind, some persistence of the old mentality. Moreover, the ethical aim in yoga is different from that of the external idea of virtue. Ordinarily, ethics is regarded as a sort of machinery of right action. The act is everything, and how to do the right act is the whole question and the whole trouble. But to the yogin, action is chiefly important, not for its own sake, but rather as a means for the growth of the soul Godward. Therefore, what Indian spiritual writings lay stress upon is not so much the quality of the action to be done as the quality of the soul from which the action flows, upon its truth, fearlessness, purity, love, compassion, benevolence, absence of the will to hurt, and upon the actions as their outflowings. This is interesting, and this is echoed through lots of spiritual traditions. This idea of this self that becomes more and more divine, we find in the Gita, in the 17th chapter, shlokas 26 and 27. I think I'll read a quick English translation from Sri Aurobindo. Sat means good, and it means existence. And the word sat is used in the sense of a good work. So it means existence, what is good, and what is a good work. All firm abiding in sacrifice, the motive of giving. Not sacrifice, tearing it out of me, but here I offer something to you, a fruit, a flower. All firm abiding in sacrifice, giving, and tapasya, because one works also effortfully for that, are sat. And Sri Aurobindo adds, for all good works prepare the soul for the higher reality of our being. So we do the work, we undertake ethical action because it sharpens us, purifies us, polishes us, and makes us ready for the divine existence. So again, Gita 17, 26 and 7. But also these ideas that not the quality of the action, but the quality of the soul. When Buddha was differentiating his teaching from what was typically understood to be Brahmanism, with a strong pronouncement about what should be done, what should not be done, the nature of the sacrifice, what is the ordination. Of course, there was concern, what if I do the sacrifice wrong? Does it fall back on me? What if I live incorrectly? Does that fall back on me? And Buddha had a deep insight and shared it, that it isn't so much the accidental thing that you do that pursues you. It's the thing that you do by design. It's when you intend to do something crooked or wrong, that sticks with you. Your conscious actions are what count the most. And of course, for Buddha, there's no moment when one should not be conscious. You should be aware. He was Buddha. He was awake, not sleeping. But for most people, they come to wakefulness only from time to time. And do they come to full wakefulness? They may have glimpses of a greater self, a deeper reality. But when one knows what one is, as Brahman did, as said in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, then knowing that you're whole, you can't do poorly. And you have nothing to fear because you are whole. Happily, all of us is an aspect of that single being which Brahman is. So we contain, in essence, that very freedom from fear and that very perfection in being. The old Western idea that human nature is intrinsically bad and virtue is a thing to be followed out in spite, out in despite of our fallen nature, to which it is contrary, is foreign to the Indian mentality trained from ancient times and the ideas of the yogins. Our nature contains, as well as its passionate rajasic and its downward tending tamasic quality, a pure sattvic element, and it is the encouragement of this, its highest part, which is the business of ethics. By it, we increase the divine nature, divine prakriti, which is present in us, and get rid of the titanic and demoniac elements. They fall away like dead leaves off the tree. This is a quote from the Gita, chapter 9, shloka 13. Let's read that. The great souled, the Mahatmas, who dwell in the divine nature, Daivim Prakriti, know me as the imperishable Avyayam, from whom all existences originate. And so knowing, they turn to me with a soul and entire love, suggesting a communion and a satisfying connection. So, chapter 9. By the way, we're talking about action here, and we talked about divine rule above and the representative divine rule here. This is chapter 9 in the Gita, which is the Rajavidya Rajaguhya Yoga chapter. So it's the chapter of the secret of the king. Not, therefore, the Hebraic righteousness of the God-fearing man, but the purity, love, beneficence, truth, fearlessness, harmlessness of the saint and the God-lover are the goal of the ethical growth according to this notion. Go back to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, shloka 6. And speaking more largely, to grow into the divine nature is the consummation of the ethical being. This can be done best by realizing God as the higher self, Paramatman, the guiding and uplifting will of the Master whom we love and serve. Not fear of him, but love of him, and aspiration to the freedom and eternal purity of his being must be the motive. Note that he's brought back in here the stationing of us in the real existence, the goal of yoga. The actuation of that divine in life, the goal of karma yoga. And obviously, we're talking about the yoga of love. So all three elements, all finding fructification in union with that, with him, with her. Certainly, fear enters into the relations of the master and the servant, and even of the father and the child, but only when they are on the human level, when control and subjection and punishment figure predominantly in them, and love is obliged to efface itself more or less behind the mask of authority. The divine, even as the master, does not punish anybody, does not threaten, does not force obedience. Remember in the book, The Mother, Sri Aurobindo writes this section about she will permit the soul laboring in ignorance to have the fruit of its own action in the ignorance. If I insist on doing this thing, well, very good, you have ordered it, we will deliver it. Here's what you chose from the menu. Are you happy now? It is the human soul that has freely to come to the divine and offer itself to his overpowering force that he may seize and uplift it towards his own divine levels. And give it that joy of mastery of the finite nature by the infinite and of service to the highest, by which there comes freedom from the ego and the lower nature. Rigveda, Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Love is the key of this relation. And this service, dasyam, is in Indian yoga, the happy service of the divine friend or the passionate service to the divine beloved. The master of the worlds, who in the Gita demands of his servant, the bhakta, to be nothing more in life than his instruments, makes this claim as the friend, the guide, the higher self, and describes himself as the Lord of all the worlds, who is the friend of all creatures. Sarva Loka Maheshwaram Suhurdam Sarva Bhutanam. The two relations, in fact, must go together, and neither can be perfect without the other. More fully, that's Gita, chapter 5, shloka 29, the last shloka in that chapter. When one knows me as the enjoyer of the sacrifice, your gift, and tapasya, enjoying your work, the mighty Lord of the worlds, the friend of the creatures, he comes to peace. And that is unity of being that goes beyond the numinous experience where God is big and scary, and you move into the being of the divine. That's the mystic experience. The mystical is differentiated from the numinous. So too, it is not the fatherhood of God as the creator who demands obedience because he is the maker of our being, but the fatherhood of love, which leads us toward the closer soul union of yoga. Love is the real key in both, and perfect love is inconsistent with the admission of the motive of fear. One longs for the communion, the erasure of difference, the closing of the gulf, and bhakti, from the root bhaj, aims at connection, a reunion, a fulfillment. Closeness of the human soul to the divine is the object. And fear sets always a barrier and a distance. Even awe and reverence for the divine power are a sign of distance and division, and they disappear in the intimacy of the union of love. Moreover, fear belongs to the lower nature, to the lower self. And in approaching the higher self, must be put aside before we can enter into its presence. Well, I think that's an ample bit of reading for the evening. So we'll put our bookmarks there and close with a section from Savitri. This is in book Yes, this is in book 7, the book of yoga. And this is canto 5, the finding of the soul. And we'll start on page 529. All underwent a high celestial change. Breaking the black inconscience blind mute wall, effacing the circles of the ignorance, powers and divinities burst flaming forth. Each part of the being, trembling with delight, lay overwhelmed with tides of happiness, and saw her hand in every circumstance, and felt her touch in every limb and cell. In the country of the lotus of the head, which thinking mind has made its busy space, in the castle of the lotus twixt the brows, whence it shoots the arrows of its sight and will, in the passage of the lotus of the throat, where speech must rise, and the expressing mind and the heart's impulse run towards word and act, a glad uplift and a new working came. The immortal's thoughts displaced our bounded view. The immortal's thoughts, earth's drab idea and sense. All things now bore a deeper, heavenlier sense. A glad, clear harmony marked their truth's outline, reset the balance and measures of the world. Each shape showed its occult design, unveiled God's meaning in it for which it was made, and the vivid splendor of his artist thought. A channel of the mighty mother's choice, the immortal's will took into its calm control our blind or erring government of life. A loose republic once of wants and needs, then bowed to the uncertain sovereign mind, life now obeyed to a diviner rule, and every act became an act of God. In the kingdom of the lotus of the heart, love, chanting its pure hymeneal hymn, made life and body mirrors of sacred joy, and all the emotions gave themselves to God. In the navel lotus's broad imperial range, its proud ambitions and its master lusts were tamed into instruments of a great calm sway to do a work of God on earthly soil. In the narrow nether center's petty parts, its childish game of daily dwarf desires was changed into a sweet and boisterous play, a romp of little gods with life in time. In the deep place, where once the serpent slept, there came a grip on matter's giant powers for large utilities in life's little space. A firm ground was made for heaven's descending might. Behind all reigned her sovereign deathless soul, casting aside its veil of ignorance, allied to gods and cosmic beings and powers, it built the harmony of its human state, surrendered into the great world mother's hands. Only she obeyed her soul's supreme behest in the enigma of the inconscient world. A secret soul behind, supporting all, is master and witness of our ignorant life, admits the person's look and nature's role. But once the hidden doors are flung apart, then the veiled king steps out in nature's front. A light comes down into the ignorance. Its heavy, painful knot loosens its grasp. the mind becomes a mastered instrument, and life a hue and figure of the soul. All happily grows towards knowledge and towards bliss. Namaste. Jai Ma.